This is the final chapter of the unit. It's all about membrane structure and function. And what? No, it's its own chapter. But it's the final chapter of this unit. So when I'm done with this one, then we'll have the test, exam two. The opening slide is something we've already talked a little bit about in a previous chapter, namely that phospholipids are the major component of cell membrane material, whether it's plasma membrane or membranes making up membrane-bounded organelles that we've talked about. So membrane material is basically the same stuff, which is mostly phospholipids arranged in a bilayer. And we've also talked about the fact that the bilayer itself, two monolayers, forms automatically without any life if you simply expose phospholipid molecules to water. And this is how the first cells came into existence, or the first cell-like structures. Before you actually have cells, you have things that are very similar to them, bags basically made out of phospholipid bilayers. Now, what is it? What attribute of phospholipids accounts for the fact that phospholipid bilayers spontaneously form in the presence of water? They're amphipathic. Right. Amphipathic, remember, means having dual preferences. An amphipathic molecule is one that is polar at one part of the cell, one part of the molecule, and nonpolar at another part of the same molecule. So let's quickly review how a phospholipid is built. Very similar to how a fat is built. What's another two other names for a fat? Triglyceride or fat or triacylglycerol, which is, I think, the best term because it tells you how it's built. A fat, which is not a phospholipid, so don't think that I'm describing the picture here. A fat, remember, starts with a glycerol molecule. And what is glycerol? It's an alcohol, right. It's actually a triple alcohol because there are three OHs on it. And each of those OHs is a potential connection point for adding other things to make a bigger molecule, like in the production of a fat, right? You start with a glycerol, and then in the case of a fat, what you connect to each of these three points is a fatty acid. They can be the same as each other or three different ones, but you put three fatty acids onto a glycerol, and that makes a triglyceride or a triacylglycerol or a fat. Well, what is a fatty acid? How would you describe it chemically? It's a hydrocarbon with what at the end? Carboxyl, exactly. So it's not technically a hydrocarbon simply because a carboxyl has an oxygen in it. But except for that carboxyl at the end, the whole rest of the tail is hydrocarbon. And hydrocarbons in general are nonpolar, right? Because carbon and hydrogen have almost equal electronegativities, therefore the sharing of electrons between carbon and hydrogen is almost equal, nonpolar. Okay, but the carboxyl allows you to bind that fatty acid to one of the three places on the glycerol. And if you do that with three different fatty acids, you make a fat or triglyceride. That's not what we have here, but it's similar. Not shown in the head is a glycerol molecule of each phospholipid, an individual phospholipid. Just imagine one of these. Has a glycerol in it just like a fat does, with three places you can connect things. But in the case of a phospholipid, only two of those things two of those connection points is made with fatty acids. So that's why there are two tails, not three. But otherwise, they're just like the fatty acids in a fat. Okay? They are nonpolar. What do you connect to the third connection point of glycerol if you're making a fatty phospholipid? A phosphate group, right, which is why they're called phospholipids. And how do you describe a phosphate group? What's it? What is that functional group? No. It has a phosphorus atom and four oxygen atoms, including ionized oxygen atom. So a phosphate group by itself as a group is beyond polar, right? It's not only not nonpolar, it's even more charged than polar. Polar means partially charged. Ionized is fully charged. So in the head is where the phosphate is, and that's why the overall phospholipid is amphipathic. The phosphate of the head makes that part of the molecule polar, and the fatty acid tails, being mostly hydrocarbons, make that part of the same molecule nonpolar. Therefore, the overall thing is amphipathic. The heads have the preference of liking to being around other polar things like water, which is why we call them hydrophilic, water-loving. Hydrophilic is functionally the same thing as polar. They go hand in hand. The tails are hydrophobic, water-fearing. They don't want to be around water because they are not polar like water is. They are nonpolar. And therefore, if you just have a bunch of them and you expose them all to water, they're going to arrange themselves in such a way that these tails don't have to be around water. They do that by making two monolayers, making up an overall bilayer, in which the tails in one monolayer are facing the tails of the other monolayer. That leaves the heads exposed to water either outside or inside, which they have no problem being around because they're hydrophilic, polar. Okay, so that's how the first cell-like bags came into existence, as phospholipids themselves accumulated in the oceans because of the early Earth conditions that we've talked about. You know, slowly these phospholipids accumulated, and eventually they started forming bilayers. And the first cells that are the ancestors to all organisms came from those. But the first bags that formed could not be cells yet, because a phospholipid bilayer is a pure phospholipid bilayer made up of nothing else, cannot function as a plasma membrane of a living cell. And that's because if you have a purely phospholipid bilayer, it will be selectively permeable, meaning certain things will be able to get through it and certain other things won't. The problem is some of those things that can't get through it happen to be things that any living cell has to be able to get into and out of itself. So even though phospholipid bilayers are the substructure, the major component of any plasma membrane of any cell that's ever existed, there has to be other things in that phospholipid bilayer to allow the membrane to be permeable to things that cells need to exchange with their surroundings. So this is not a living plasma membrane. I mean, a plasma membrane of a living cell. On the other hand, slide 2 shows you that a plasma membrane of a true cell, an organism, is not just phospholipid bilayer. There's other things in there as well, including, importantly, all of these purple things shown here, which are proteins of various sorts. So the proteins aren't the only other components of a plasma membrane, but they are really important. And any protein that is part of the membrane is an example of a membrane-bound protein. This is where I was telling you probably weeks ago now that there's a difference between the two phrases, membrane-bounded and membrane-bound. Membrane bound means part of a membrane, like these are. They're not surrounded by their own membranes, which is what membrane bounded means. Okay, so these are membrane bound proteins. They do various things that we'll look at in plasma membranes of living cells. Before we look at their functions, though, let me just tell you that the phospholipid bilayer, when it forms, does not result in any covalent bonding between phospholipids. So these phospholipids are arranged this way just for the tails to avoid water. That doesn't mean they get chemically connected to each other. They're still individual molecules able to move around. All right? Similarly, there is nothing holding this, there's no chemical bonds holding any of these proteins in place. What keeps a membrane-bound protein like this in the membrane is the same thing that makes the bilayer form to begin with. So you have to think back to what we've already talked about regarding proteins. Any individual polypeptide is one long ribbon, right? It's just one sequence of amino acids that the ribbon folds back and forth in some shape. But keep in mind how what holds it together. A polypeptide is held together by the carboxyl of one amino acid and the amino of the next amino acid, and that's it. The R groups, which are the only things variable about amino acids, do not contribute to the holding together the sequence. They're just hanging off of the backbone. All right? But the R groups are the things that make it fold up into a specific shape. You don't see a ribbon here, but imagine one ribbon has two ends, but it's folded up into this overall shape. And along the ribbon are the individual amino acids, each with its own R group. Okay? Well, the amino acids in this region, which is near the inner surface of the cell membrane, and also the ones that are in this region of the overall necklace or ribbon, happen to have R groups that are polar. Remember, we categorized the amino acids based on polar, nonpolar, or fully charged. So these polar R groups make these edges of this overall protein have no problem being around the water, which is polar. But the R groups of the amino acids in this region of the same protein are nonpolar R groups, and therefore they don't want to be around water, and they have no problem being around these nonpolar tails of the phospholipids.
So they're amphipathic, just like the binder?
Yes. And imagine what keeps it here really is it's basically floating in this, kind of like a buoy in water. If you imagine trying to push this protein either into the cell or out of the cell, it doesn't matter which direction. If you try to do that, either way you're going to have to expose some of these polar R groups that are now on the edge to the interior thickness of the membrane, which is where the nonpolar tails are. You're going to expose polar to nonpolar, and it's not going to like it. So if you just push it a little bit of away and then remove the force, it'll spring right back into place this way. If you try to push it the other way, you're going to expose these polar R groups to the nonpolar region. And it's not going to like that. So that's what holds it in place. No covalent bonds. But it's also going to not exit the cell or enter the cell. It's going to stay as part of the membrane. Okay, now on 3, we can see that if you study a plasma membrane structure for any given cell, some of the membrane-bound proteins, well, there's some collection of membrane-bound proteins in general in any given plasma membrane. What you see is that there isn't an equal distribution of proteins with respect to which of the two monolayers that the proteins are associated with. You can show that by using a special technique called freeze fracturing. Where you get it cold enough, you can basically separate the two monolayers as shown here. And if you do that, some of the proteins stay with one monolayer, some of the proteins stay with the other monolayer. But it's not equal. It's not half of the proteins go to the outer layer and half go to the inner layer. What you see is that the majority of membrane-bound proteins are more associated with the cytoplasmic layer, the layer that's in contact with the interior of the cell, which should make sense because the proteins are doing various functions, most of which are occurring inside the cell, and that's why you have this distribution. All right, now we need to talk about the fluid mosaic model of membrane structure. The fluid mosaic describes an actual plasma membrane, which is mostly phospholipids, but more than that, as I've just said. But to understand why that is a descriptive phrase, we need to know what the words mean. What is a mosaic? Yeah, not necessarily glass, but it's a piece of art that uses pieces of something. It could be tile. Any solid chunks you want to use for a mosaic are then glued to some surface, like a wall, for instance. And so they make up what are more or less like pixels of a graphic image. Okay, so that's why it's a plasma membrane is a mosaic, because each of these individual phospholipids or proteins is like one tile in the mosaic. But unlike an art mosaic in which they are held in place, they're glued to the surface, this is a fluid mosaic. Fluid means able to flow. And so this is what I was talking about before when I said that the phospholipids in the bilayer are not covalently bonded to each other. They're free to move around. Each monolayer of the bilayer is kind of like a crowd of people. Right, we're looking at it on edge here, but you could be viewing this from above in this view, looking down on the heads, just like you could look down on a crowd of people from a skyscraper. And, you know, like I usually use the example of Times Square at New Year's Eve, because it's a huge crowd of people. They're right next to each other. But they're not connected to each other, right? If you take snapshots at different parts of the night as they get drunker and drunker, they're not going to be with the same people continuously. They're moving around within the same, you know, they're still on the street level, so they're in the same layer, but they're switching places with each other. That's a fluid mosaic. And the other monolayer is the same way, making up the bilayer. Well, you can see at the top how frequently this happens, and it might surprise you just how fluid the mosaic is. Lateral movement to the side, which is what lateral means switching places with phospholipid in the same monolayer. It's like the people in the crowd moving around with respect to each other. And that happens about 10 million times per second. So that's just part of the overall dynamism or continual change that a plasma membrane has. Or the cell in general is highly dynamic, continuously changing. The plasma membrane, though, itself is buzzing because of this movement of phospholipids next to each other. Much rarer is a flip-flop, as shown here, which involves the phospholipid in one monolayer swapping positions with the phospholipid in another monolayer. And it should make sense why that is rare. Same reason that a protein is held in place within the membrane, right? If you try to force this flip-flop to happen, you're at least temporarily going to have to expose the head, which is polar, to the nonpolar tail thickness to get it to the other side. And so it doesn't happen very often, only once a month or so. Okay, so that's the fluid mosaic model. And it's important for the plasma membrane to have the right fluidity, which is a variable that can be changed by the cell itself, but also is affected by the environment. For instance, if the temperature is low, that's going to tend to make everything more solidified, right? It's going to make a plasma membrane, just due to the temperature itself, it's going to make it less fluid. Well, it could possibly make it not fluid enough, in other words. So the cell would need to respond by loosening it up. And it can do that by adjusting what kind of phospholipids get incorporated into the membrane. Remember we talked about membrane material moving around? Well, part of doing that involves changing the plasma membrane components from moment to moment. So think back to when we talked about the different kinds of fats. These aren't fats, they're phospholipids, but the same thing applies. Fats can be either saturated or non-saturated, right? A non-saturated fatty acid is one that has at least one double bond, and that gives you a kink, and therefore they don't pack together as well, like the bent wires I was talking about in my analogy. So that would be the appropriate response if it gets too cold. Put more phospholipids that feature unsaturated fatty acids into the mix, and they will make it more loose, which would be appropriate when it tightens up too much. And just the opposite, if the temperature gets too high, it would make things too loose, and the cell can tighten it back up appropriately by taking out the phospholipids that have unsaturated fatty acids and put in ones that are purely saturated that pack together a lot tighter. Now on the bottom, this is an animal example because animals are the organisms that make cholesterol, as I've talked about. And I've already talked about several reasons why animals can't live without cholesterol. Well, here's another reason. The fluidity of animal plasma membranes is greatly affected by how much cholesterol is embedded in there. This is why the cells of the body in general need to be able to make cholesterol. We talked about last time that there's a lot of cholesterol molecules made by liver cells, but cells throughout the body need to be able to make cholesterol because they all have membranes, and animal membranes need cholesterol as a component. Cholesterol not only affects the fluidity of the membrane, how loose or tight it is, but it also affects the permeability of the membrane to certain particles like ions. Five. This will probably be the last slide. This is a cartoon that shows you the results of a test, of an experiment that was designed to test whether the fluid mosaic model is correct. So you have two different kinds of cells here, one from a mouse, one from a human. Obviously, each of them has proteins embedded in their membranes because they're alive. But just as obviously, that set of proteins is not identical. There are mouse proteins in the one, and there are human proteins in the other. And they used a chemical technique to label the proteins. They didn't really get in there and color them magenta and violet, but same thing. They could keep track of them by marking them chemically. All right, and then they fused them with a special technique into one cell, a hybrid cell that is half human, half mouse. Well, if the fluid mosaic model were not true, then you would expect this hybrid cell to remain like it is when they first made the fusion. In other words, the mouse protein should be on one side and the human protein should be on the other side, and they should stay there. Non-fluid, in other words. On the other hand, if the fluid mosaic model is true, then you should see these proteins be able to diffuse each down its own gradient and go all the way across the surface of the cell and be a mixture of mouse and human proteins, which is exactly what they saw. So it's pretty good evidence that true cells are fluid mosaics, true cell membranes are fluid mosaics.
Does that test have a name?
Well, I'm sure it's eponymously named after the investigators that did it, but I don't know their names. Might be something you can look up, but I don't happen to know it, no. Okay, so I'll try to remember that we're on 6 next time. Let's stop.